Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, this April 25th, 2010. We've got a great guest for you today. It's going to be an extraordinary show. We'll have full hour with Noam Chomsky. But before we go to our guest, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. Spot Us, the community-funded journalism project born in San Francisco in 2008, has now expanded its coverage to Seattle. The nonprofit project has pioneered community-powered reporting, allowing the public to commission and support specific investigative journalism stories, as well as participate in some aspects of the reporting. Seattle is the third area to join the Spot Us network. The organization also operates in the Bay Area and Los Angeles. Spot Us is pairing up with three journalists in the Emerald City, including veteran investigative journalist Rita Hibbard. Hibbard worked for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer for 20 years. She is now editor of Investigate West, a nonprofit organization focused on investigative journalism in the Pacific Northwest and the West. Hibbard said projects like Spot Us and Investigate West are stepping in to cover the stories that are often not told by mainstream media.
Well, it's important to keep the community watchdogs there, and I think that's where we come in, because we're able to take stories like this and ask these kinds of questions and report them and then come back to the community with the answers.
With the help of Spot Us, Hibbard and the team at Investigate West are asking the public to fund an investigation about the cruise ship industry in Seattle, focusing on how much waste is produced by cruise ships. The city greets 800,000 cruise ship tourists a year.
It's really asking citizens to value media. And to me, that's really important, and it's really heartening, and it's really a tribute to the value that citizens are willing to put on their watchdogs, going out into the community and asking questions. And I think it's also a tribute to, you know, if journalists are asking the right questions and doing the stories that matter to people and matter to citizens and matter to communities, it's a good synergy of kind of bringing that together.
Citizens have contributed nearly $100,000 to fund stories through Spot Us. To find out more, visit spot.us or invw.org.
Video journalist Josh Wolfe made headlines in 2006 when he was jailed for refusing to turn over videotapes he recorded during an anti-G8 anarchist demonstration in San Francisco. Wolfe, who was covering the protest for Bay Area Indie Media, served the longest sentence ever given to a reporter for protecting source materials, 226 days in a federal prison. Wolfe is now a first-year student at the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. One of the first stories he covered was a student occupation of Wheeler Hall on the Berkeley campus last November. His footage was used later in a Democracy Now! Segment about the protests. Wolfe and Democracy Now! Reporter Brandon Jordan were arrested with the protesters. All were processed and released, and the charges were later dismissed. But the school pressed forward with sanctions against the students. Wolfe now faces the same fate as the protesters, the choice of settling informally with a 7-month suspension or taking his chances with a student conduct proceeding that could end in permanent dismissal from the university. Wolfe is not inclined to accept the suspension and will once again test the boundaries of journalistic freedom.
I do feel the impacts of the very issues that prompted this protest the same as every other student. I cannot say that I'm neutral about my tuition going up. However, I went into the building to document what happened inside, whether that be the goings-on or should the event that there be a police confrontation at some point, to document whatever happens there, because I think it's important that that be seen. My role to go inside the building wasn't to stack chairs or barricade doors or anything like that. My role that I went in was to document what I saw.
Wolf admits that it is more difficult for police to discern reporters from spectators and participants. After all, everyone has at least a cell phone camera these days. But, he says, we need to have policies that hold police accountable for bad arrests made to thwart the reporting of an incident involving them. Wolf says that there are some protections in place, like shield and libel laws. He would like to see a federal shield law because some of the state laws are weak. But much of the problem needs to be addressed through more responsible policies on the whole that protect civil liberties for everyone.
Journalists, as journalists, should not be in some separate class, be afforded some protections that regular citizens are not afforded, because anyone can commit journalism. It's the journalism itself that we need to protect and not the journalists.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Today, our guest is, well, someone who really doesn't need much of an introduction, Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at MIT, author of numerous books and articles on politics and language, and probably the best-known guest we've ever had on our program. We're doing this program, recording it, a couple of weeks before going on air, so please don't call in. Sit back, relax, and let us do the talking today. Noam Chomsky, welcome to Media Matters.
Very glad to be back with you.
Well, what I'd like to talk about today, when we've had you on the show before, we've oftentimes talked about U.S. foreign policy, the Middle East, the wars in Iraq, militarism and empire, questions that have been central to your political work for your adult life. And I want to talk maybe about those to some extent, but really I'd like to focus on other themes that you've talked about throughout your life, too, that relate to this, which is the United States, the domestic scene. And recently you were at the Left Forum in New York City, and you gave the keynote address there. And the title of your keynote address was "The Center Cannot Hold: Rekindling the Radical Imagination." And I had the privilege of reading a draft of the talk. And I'd like to talk a little bit about your assessment about where we are in the United States today. And let's maybe start with the title, "The Center Cannot Hold." What do you mean by that?
Actually, that was the theme of the Left Forum, but I was happy with it. What they're saying is that the mainstream political system is collapsing. They're right. The public hatred and contempt for Congress, the executive, in fact, just about all institutions, is at historic heights. I mean, right now, about half the population thinks that every member of Congress, including their own representatives, should be kicked out. Distrust is just enormous. I can't remember a period like it. In fact, in that talk, I mentioned the one thing that it reminds me of, late Weimar Germany. If you go back to late Weimar Germany, that's just what was happening.
And by late Weimar, just for the sake of some of our younger listeners who have been victims of our public education system, we're referring to Germany in the 1920s, immediately prior to
the early 30s.
Yeah.
I mean, if you know, Hitler was appointed chancellor by Hindenburg, who hated him. Hindenburg was an aristocrat. He hated this little corporal, as he called him. But he had to appoint him chancellor just because of the enormous popular support in 1933. Now, in 1928, 5 years earlier, the Nazis had gotten less than 3% of the vote. Very similar to this. I mean, there were traditional liberal conservative parties that had been in power, you know, ever since the Reich was established, and they were squabbling, not doing anything. I mean, people were just sick of them. They wanted to destroy the whole parliamentary system. And when this charismatic figure came along, offering them hope, you know, power, restoring Germany's magnificence, and on and on. And he was charismatic. He was sent by the Lord to do all this. They swept the country. I mean, by 1933, the Nazis, surely if they took power, declared May Day a workers' holiday. The left parties had never been able to do that, and the left parties were very strong in Germany. It's not like here. The Social Democrats and the Communists were huge parties, and they had associations, and you know, the whole based in a real live community. They'd never been able to do it. The Nazis did it. A million people showed up in Berlin, which was called Red Berlin because it was a left city, and it just went on from there. By the time you get to 1939, you know, the beginning of the war. Estimates are that about 90% of the population was right behind them. It's uncannily similar to what's going on here.
Are you referring specifically, when you talk about the Nazi movement and the Third Reich, to what we see in what the Tea Party movement here in the United States?
What's called the Tea Party movement, which you know has maybe no coherent... in fact, the only coherent ideology it has is let's shoot ourselves in the feet. Because their policies, if you look at them, are going to be self-destructive. But it is appealing to people who think the political system is shot, nobody pays any attention to us. These are people with real grievances, as in Germany. I mean, for 30 years, you know, ever since the financialization of the economy set in, wages have stagnated, declined for the majority. Benefits, which were never great, have declined. The working hours have increased. Debt has increased. And they see there's plenty of wealth. I mean, there is ostentatious wealth, but it's going into very few pockets. We have probably the worst inequality in the country's history. And right now, in the last year or two, what people see is devastating. The banks crashed the economy. The government moved in to save them, meaning the taxpayer bailed them out. Now the banks are doing great, and we're still unemployed. So here you've got this completely dysfunctional political system. Parties don't care about us. The government obviously doesn't. Okay, someone comes along with a message that says, I care about you, and here's something that'll bring us all together. It's you know, I don't want to say it's the Nazis, but... there's a kind of similarity that's eerie, and in fact, it's extremely.
Well, so the sort of something's been lost, this heroic past that it's to be resurrected.
They're reconstructing the heroic past.
Yeah,
I mean, it's something that you know Reagan was able to do. That's noble history, and so on and so forth. And that's deep in American society. It goes way back, even in intellectual culture as well. You know, American exceptionalism, the world's against us, we got to defend ourselves, we got to sort of control the world in order to defend ourselves. If we want to send drones out to kill somebody in Yemen, we got to do it to defend ourselves, and so on. So that kind of nationalist fervor, the you know recovery of an imagined heroic past, fits very well with the sense of you can't really call it discontent, that's not strong enough. But the kind of hopelessness and fear about the internal collapse, they go together. And it's huge. By now, latest polls, about close to half the population sympathize with the what they call the Tea Party movement. They're not in it, but they sympathize with its mood, you know, the patriotic, you know, it's quite interesting if you look at their actual views. I mean, it's just an offshoot. It's just essentially run by the corporate sector. I mean, they're the ones who provide the funding, the ideology, and they know what they're doing. And they have a very tricky propaganda message, which has been going on for 50 years. Business propaganda has to do two contradictory things. It has to get people to hate the government and regard the government as an enemy, you know, like some alien force. And say we're in favor of small government and so on. On the other hand, they have to get people to love the government and want a big government, a powerful state. So take Reagan, you know, he's considered the apostle of free markets and, you know, small government. I mean, the government grew under Reagan. He was the most protectionist president in post-war American history, believed in massive intervention in the economy. But they constructed the image, and they're now... you know, a very, very standard now, you know, probably large majority says, oh, we got to get rid of the federal government. It's in our hair. You know, it's too big. It's deeply in debt and so on. On the other hand, these very same people are massively supporting government growth and government power. And for the business world, that means we need a big state, but a nanny state for the rich.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about cutting government, we mean cutting everything that you care about. and to sell that message is rather sophisticated, and they've done a good job on it.
Our guest is Noam Chomsky, who you've just been listening to. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580, coming to you today, April 25th, 2010. From beautiful Urbana, Illinois. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it a couple weeks before going on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, enjoy the program, if not always the content of the program, given the nature of what we're talking about and the severity of it. Noam Chomsky, in your work in the 70s and 80s in particular, you put a great deal of attention on the news media as sort of being crucial to the propaganda system, the ideological system, making the system work effectively and efficiently. And your work on your own and with Ed Herman, I think, educated a generation. I'm proud to say I'm one of that generation, to how to understand news media and how they work. You haven't written as much about it in recent times. You've been focusing on other stuff. Do the news media still play such an important function as they did in those days?
Yeah, in fact, I wouldn't say there's been any. In this respect, they're fundamentally the same as when I was a kid, you know, 75 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are big changes, like you've talked about them. We don't have to go over them. But the fundamental point is the same, and they're not that different from the general intellectual culture. It's a point. We studied the media. I studied the media. Mm-hmm. But that's because you can study them more analytically, like you can do a study of everything that appeared in the world press, to try to look at the general culture, you know, scholarship, journals, commentary. That's a much harder task. It's to do it systematically. But when you do it, I don't think you find huge differences. I mean, there are other effects in the media, you know, the corporate structure and so on, but it's not missing in the universities either, you know. And so take today. I mean, there are two huge issues. I mean, they dwarf anything else, because they're issues of survival. One is nuclear weapons. The other is environmental destruction. And the media are doing a terrible job on both. They're not, I mean, if you really look carefully, you can find the data. But these issues are presented in such a way as to diminish the significance of things that are taking place and to divert attention away from what really matters. I mean, take say global warming.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a substantial business campaign. Here's another case of internal contradiction. It's kind of interesting to look at. The business world, the chambers of commerce, you know, American Petroleum Institute and so on, have engaged in a huge propaganda campaign, which means the media, to try to convince people that there's no human impact on, if it's taking place at all, which maybe it isn't, there's no human impact. Now, the same CEOs who are running those campaigns, they have the same views that you and I have. They know it's very serious. It could be catastrophic. It's going to destroy what they own, you know. But nevertheless, they're kind of institutionally required to get people not to believe it. And there's a good reason for it. It's a quasi-market system, you know. And in a market system, you have very few choices if you're in a management position. You must act to maximize short-term profit and gain, and you must dismiss what economists call externalities, effects on others. Well, in this case, the externality happens to be survival of the species. But when you're operating in this system, you can't pay attention to that. Just as if you'd say, you sell me a car, we're supposed to make a deal that's good for us, but we don't talk about the effects on somebody else. Well, in this case, the externalities happen to be rather significant, the fate of the species. Nevertheless, the same individual is compelled, really, just by institutional facts, to try to undermine belief in it. If this individual decides, I'm not going to do it, he'll be out and somebody else will be in, because it's an institutional effect. Well, the effect of this is concern over the environment has declined very sharply in the United States. By now, the last figures I saw, barely a third of the population thought that humans have anything to do with global warming. There was just a book that came out a little while ago by an Australian political economist, a very good one, called Requiem for the Species. This is what he's talking about. Now, how do the media handle this? Well, if you look at the media, for example, the New York Times had a front page story a week or two ago on, in which they said, well, they're talking about the dissent over global warming. They said, well, the scientists say it's real, but then the meteorologists, the guys on the radio who, you know, say it's going to rain tomorrow, they say it's not real. So we have a real conflict. I mean, on the one hand, the scientists, on the other hand, a pretty face who says, you know, it's going to rain tomorrow because they read something and give it. Well, that's the way it's been presented. I mean, on the one hand, you have 99% of scientists. On the other hand, you have Rush Limbaugh and Jim Inhofe and maybe two or three scientists they can pick up, and they get equal time. Well, that's bad enough, but it's much worse than that. Because when they talk about skeptics, global warming skeptics, they're talking about the people who deny it. But there's a much bigger and more significant group of global warming skeptics who aren't barely mentioned, namely the scientists who think that the estimates are much too conservative. They're far more important than Rush Limbaugh. But occasionally there'll be a word from them here scattered around. But it's framed as a debate between two parallel groups, you know, the kind of pointy-headed liberal scientists and the common-sense people who say there's nothing happening. Well, that is a requiem for the species. And for the business world, it makes sense in the terms of short-term profit, market share, even though they themselves know that they're destroying themselves and destroying the lives of their grandchildren. It's what Orwell called doublethink, you know, the ability to have two ideas in mind which are contradictory and believe in both. And that's almost like a motto for the propaganda system. I mean, the people who are running the destructive propaganda know what they're doing. It's the same in the financial system. I mean, these guys are not stupid. They understand systemic risk. I mean, they know that if you enter into market transactions and you disregard the effects on others, which you must do or else you're out of the game, you're disregarding what economists call systemic risk, the chance that if what you're Goldman Sachs, you know, you sell crummy securities, you take out an insurance policy to save you when they collapse. That's what they did with AIG. It's a huge risk. So that's systemic risk, but you don't take it into account. And you really don't have to, because when the whole system collapses, the taxpayer comes in, thanks to the government, and bails you out, and you're richer than before. I mean, that's what people are angry about. Well, okay, they're now setting themselves up for the next and probably bigger financial crisis, consciously. Well, you can read it in the business press. You say, well, it's going to happen because we're disregarding systemic risk, and we have to. That's the way market systems work. I mean, theoretically, you could have regulation, government regulation, which could overcome this. But in order for that to be, you can't really have that when the financial institutions run the government.
Yeah.
So, and when they pretty much run the media and so on. So you can sort of, if you're careful, you can figure out what's going on. But it's the logic of the financial crisis and of the environmental crisis are rather similar. I mean, these are market inefficiencies, and you can only overcome them with a functioning democratic government. But since the democratic government is pretty much in the pocket of the people who are making the economic decisions, well, it's a bind. And in the case of the environment, it may mean destroying the species, you know, virtually destroying the species. The same is true of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, please, let me just interrupt to let our listeners know you've been listening to Noam Chomsky. He's our guest here in Media Matters today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL-AM 580. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it a couple weeks before going on air, so please don't try to call in. Sit back and relax and enjoy listening to Professor Chomsky and myself, to some extent, talk for the next half hour or so. And we've been talking about the systematic crises that our species face and the impossibility or the difficulty our political system has addressing these structurally rooted crises. We've talked about just now financialization, and we've talked about the ecological crisis. And then I think the one you're about to talk to, which I think gets even less attention than the first two, extraordinarily enough, is the nuclear crisis.
Well, there's one element of the nuclear crisis, which may not even be a crisis, that is constantly emphasized, that dominates discussion. That's the possibility that Iran might develop nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. There's a new nuclear posture review, Obama's signature statement on nuclear posture, and he gave speeches about it. There's a ton of coverage. And what he said, and interestingly, there was no comment, is that we have to stop proliferation. Very important to stop proliferation. He said the U.S. says for the first time that it won't bomb, it won't attack states with nuclear weapons if there's signers of the non-proliferation treaty and doing all the right things. But we reserve the right to attack the outliers, as he called them, the two outliers, North Korea and Iran, who are refusing to accept non-proliferation treaty and its obligations. Well, the fact of the matter is there are three states that have never signed the non-proliferation treaty, Israel, India, and Pakistan. They all have nuclear weapons. Now, we've helped them develop the nuclear weapons. I mean, in Pakistan, it's Reagan basically said, okay, develop nuclear weapons. Israel, enough talk about. In the case of India, it's the last couple of years, the U.S.-Indian treaty, which essentially authorizes India to develop nuclear weapons and will help them. They don't say it that way, but that's what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. Read the small print. Well, here's three. These states are really dangerous. I mean, India and Pakistan have come very close to nuclear war a couple of times. The problems still remain, might happen again. Israel, again, enough to mention, it's obvious they're an aggressive, violent state. They're threatening war, constantly threatening war. They're alone in the region and not wanting to, we don't know about Iran, and to eliminate the threat of war. September, the Security Council passed a resolution, 1887, calling on all states to join the non-proliferation treaty, live up to its obligations, overcome their conflicts within the framework of the non-proliferation treaty in the UN Charter, which, if anybody cares, bans the threat of force. Now, the threat of force is across the spectrum in the United States. Every political figure who wants to appear in public has to say, yeah, we threaten force. Mm-hmm. The phrase that's used is all options are open, so we'll do whatever we like. This was depicted as a victory for Obama and kind of the world is against Iran. Well, there are two countries that are threatening force, Israel and the United States. Nobody else is. So it was directed against them. Israel refuses to sign the non-proliferation treaty. U.S. backs it. In fact, right at the same time, India responded to this. I don't know if they responded. A couple of days after the Security Council resolution, India announced that it now has developed nuclear weapons to such a scale that it can produce weapons of the same yield as the superpowers, the United States and Russia. That's pretty dangerous. If India does it, Pakistan's got to do it. Mm-hmm. They have to try to match them. At the same time, the International Atomic Energy Agency passed a resolution calling on Israel to join the non-proliferation treaty and to open up its facilities to inspection. Well, how'd the U.S. react to all of this? The U.S. immediately informed India that the resolution didn't apply to it. Obama informed Israel that it can disregard the International Atomic Energy Agency resolution. How did the media deal with this? Actually, I checked.
Mm-hmm.
The International Atomic Energy Agency report was reported in the United States in the Washington Times. It was reported...
The Mooney conservative newspaper in Washington.
Which nobody reads. You know, you read for sports or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But nothing else in the United States. Obama's informing Israel that they're immune, again, the Washington Times. It was in the Irish Times, wasn't it? I don't think it was even in the British press. It's just not important. And Europe had tried to block the resolution. They failed. But we don't talk about it.
I dare say I take no pleasure in the fact that just what you said on this show probably is the most awareness that the Americans will get.
Do you know where I found out about it?
Where?
I happened to be in Mexico for a couple of days giving talks. And I read it in the Mexican press. It was an AP report, meaning everybody had it.
Yeah, including any American newspaper.
Every newspaper editor had it. The Indian one, the one on India, I read in the Financial Times, you know, the British business newspaper. What did Obama do? Well, right at about the same time that he got the Nobel Prize, which is right around that time, the Pentagon announced that it's going to deploy what are called massive ordnance penetrators, bunker busters, they're called. The biggest bomb in the arsenal outside of nuclear weapons, you know, 13 tons, which are supposed to go through thousands of feet of reinforced concrete and so on. I mean, they're aimed at Iran. Everybody knows it. So they're going to start deploying them. I'm not sure that was reported in the U.S. And it goes on. Actually, the program was initiated under Bush, but it kind of lagged. They didn't put much attention into it. As soon as Obama came into office, he authorized acceleration of the program. And in fact, they're being deployed a couple of years early. It continues. Just a couple of weeks ago, the Navy announced that they're sending, that the U.S. is sending bunker busters to Diego Garcia. Diego Garcia is an island in the Indian Ocean that the U.S., it was a British colony. The U.S. told the British get rid of the population, so they kicked them all out. They built a big military base there. It's one of the main bases for bombing Central Asia and Middle East and so on. So it's regularly used. It's also a base for nuclear weapons. In fact, the Navy also, what the Navy just announced is that Obama's sending bunker busters there. That's a major threat against Iran and intended for that.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy also announced that they're sending submarine tenders to take care of nuclear submarines. Nuclear submarines means also carrying nuclear weapons, which are, destroy half the world. They're all being sent to Diego Garcia. Obama announced he didn't announce, but the Pentagon announced that they're accelerating delivery of them for the world, it's for Iranian ears, but it's not for American ears. So here's the outlier, Iran. Maybe they're developing nuclear weapons capability. Nobody knows. I wouldn't be surprised, but nobody knows for sure. Meanwhile, you've got countries that are really... that have huge nuclear arsenals that are very threatening, they're frightening everybody in the region, but they're not outliers.
Mm-hmm.
Try to find some discussion of this. It's worse than this. Let's go back to Diego Garcia, which is never discussed. One of the ways, if you're really interested in cutting down proliferation, you can have fancy rhetoric like Obama, or you can do something. One of the things you can do is establish nuclear weapons-free zones. It doesn't solve the whole problem, but it's a step towards mitigating the problem and leading to further steps. Well, it's being done, but in quite interesting ways, which also don't get reported. The African Union, after several years of negotiation, did establish a nuclear weapons-free zone, almost. The U.S. won't agree. And the reason the U.S. won't agree is it covers Diego Garcia, and we got to keep that as a nuclear weapons base. So the African Union, they can protest, but it's going to do them a lot of good.
Yeah.
I didn't check, but I doubt if there's a word about that here. There's also a nuclear weapons-free zone in the South Pacific. Same flaw. The U.S. won't allow the Pacific Islands to be included because it uses them for nuclear submarines, probably storage of nuclear weapons and so on. So that one can't really go into effect. But the most significant one, which I don't think is ever discussed, is the Middle East. If you think there's a threat from Iran, you know, right or wrong, a step towards mitigating it, maybe eliminating it, would be establishing a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the whole regions, the states of the region are very much in favor of that, with one exception, Israel, including Iran, incidentally. But and the U.S. is technically in favor of it, like they say, you know, yeah, nice idea. But nothing's being done, because it would mean that Israel would have to abandon its nuclear weapons, and the U.S. would not be able to deploy nuclear weapons there. And we're not going to accept that. Now, it's worth remembering that of all the countries in the world, the U.S. and Britain are specifically committed to this in a unique way. The reason is that when the U.S. and Britain invaded Iraq, they tried to provide a thin legal cover for it, which nobody took very seriously, but at least they tried. The legal cover was reference to a Security Council resolution in 1991 that ordered Saddam Hussein to eliminate his nuclear weapons. And the U.S. and Britain claimed, falsely as we know, that he hadn't done it. So that was the cover for the invasion of Iraq. We're just enforcing the Security Council resolution against the will of the Security Council, but minor footnote. But, well, if you read that resolution, Article 14 of that resolution, it commits the signers to establish a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. So the U.S. and Britain have a special commitment to this over and above everybody else. Well, you know, failure to, even if you had talked about it, even if you began to take steps towards it, it could lower whatever level of crisis there is. But the U.S. and Israel want to maintain the crisis. And in fact, they're carrying out serious threats, very serious threats. I mean, if anybody was threatening us like that, we'd wipe them off the face of the map.
Mm-hmm.
But this is okay, and it's Iran that's the outlier, not us, you know, not Israel, not India. And going back to the media, it's like 100% agreement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was waiting to see after Obama's speech about, you know, the outliers, if anyone would point out that Iran's potential capability is not the only case of a problem about the non-proliferation treaty. There are, after all, three states that won't sign it.
Mm-hmm.
And we support them all. We tell them you don't have to worry about it. Well, how come that's not an outlier?
Yeah.
Because if we do it, it's right by definition. And anything that doesn't go along with it is wrong by definition. Actually, it's the same when you read about Iran defying the world. I mean, you know, every article about mm-hmm. this is Iran is in defiance of the world community and so on and so forth. Who's the world community? For example, it's not most of the states in the world. Most of the states in the world are what's called G77. It's the remnants of the old non-aligned movement.
Mm-hmm.
That's most of the states, certainly most of the people. They vigorously support Iran's right to develop nuclear, peaceful nuclear energy as a signer of the NPT. So that's not the world. Well, what about the American people? Today, by now, I don't know, because after the propaganda the last couple of years, things have changed, I'm sure. But back in 2007, the last time there was a serious poll on this, a large majority of Americans thought that Iran has the rights of any signer of the Non-Proliferation Treaty to develop nuclear power. So they're not part of the world. In fact, the world means what's going on in Washington, the editorial offices, whatever governments you can pick up here and there who agree with you. That's the world. And it's just presented, you know, without blinking an eye. anyhow, the whole story is that with nuclear, and there's a real threat of nuclear war. It's not small. Mm-hmm. It's come pretty close in the past, and it would. It's kind of like, it's different from global warming in that destruction is instantaneous. In fact, if you look at U.S. Official policy, it is hair-raising. In fact, the worst, most extreme document that I can recall having seen is under Clinton. In 1995, the Strategic Command, which is in charge of, you know, nuclear weapons and so on, released a document. Released is a funny word. You have to look hard to find the word about it. It's called Essentials of Post-War, Post-Cold War Deterrence. So now that the Russians are gone, what do we do? And it is, as I said, hair-raising. It says nuclear weapons must be the center of our policy. They're much better than chemical and biological weapons or conventional weapons for several reasons. For one thing, their impact is overwhelming and massive, you know, not sort of slow and lingering. Mm-hmm. And for another, they cast a shadow over any crisis. So they allow us to use our conventional forces with more impunity because we're terrifying everyone. And then I go on to say that we have to maintain a national persona of irrationality and vindictiveness. We must maintain a sense of the world that we're out of control because then they'll be scared.
The drunk guy at the bar.
Yeah. Nixon was charged with having a madman theory. I don't know if he did or not. The evidence is not very good. But in this case, that's Clinton. Yeah, it's a super madman theory. We got to terrify the world as irrational and vindictive. And nuclear weapons have to be the core of our... Also, first strike. We cannot give up a first strike doctrine, even against non-nuclear states. Okay, that was official doctrine under Clinton. They sort of implemented it in presidential directives and so on. Did you ever see a word about this? I mean, it's not secret. You know, I've been writing about it for 15 years. You know, mm-hmm. It's there, you know.
Our guests you've been listening to, Noam Chomsky. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, WILL AM 580. We recorded this show a couple weeks before going on air, so please don't try to call in. Sit back, relax, and let us do the talking. Professor Chomsky, I've been using your books and articles in my classes for 20-some years now with great success. And one of the questions I invariably get from students who haven't been fully indoctrinated in how things work when they read your work is, why don't we hear more from this Chomsky guy? I mean, it seems this guy's a really smart guy. Why isn't he on television? Why isn't he a more prominent figure in our mainstream culture? And there's a certain naivety that's refreshing in a way when the question is asked. And I've often said, to some extent, I think it's you're a radical, obviously, for starters. But secondly, there are other radicals who've fared better. Has been, one, your position on the Middle East with Israel, which is sort of the third rail that you can't touch. And secondly, though, is your critique, both of the media and what I want to talk about now, intellectuals, academics, which I think, you know, you've gone places that a lot of people haven't gone. And I may have this quote wrong, and so correct me if I've got it wrong, but I think I saw something you wrote or said once where you described American academics as the most cowardly intellectual class in the world.
I don't remember saying it, but actually I wouldn't say it because there are plenty of others just like it. I mean, academic intellectuals in generally tend to be the most cowardly people around for obvious reasons, especially in the West, you know, United States, Britain, are very privileged. You know, it's a very cushy job being a professor in a university.
I know it well.
I mean, you may decide to work 80 hours a week, but it's your 80 hours.
Yeah.
It's about the one job you can think of where you're in control of your own work. Even faculties control their own work, so that's important. You're very well paid. I mean, I'll irritate some of my friends, but overly well paid.
No, that's true.
They have all kind of benefits. You're free of repression. I mean, people can yell at you or something, but you're not going to be put in jail. So you have all kinds of opportunities. You have resources. You have training. So you can tell the truth about the world if you want. Do they? I mean, there's a fringe, but it's a fringe. And what they write, though it's extremely important, will barely be, won't enter the mainstream. I mean, they may be invited as, you know, a guest, give a comment or something, but it's quite peripheral. But that's not punishment. So you have all kinds of opportunities to do important things, like what we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't do it, that's just cowardice. I mean, it's different if you think about, say, dissidents in a totalitarian state. Okay, there you have problems. You can end up in the gulag, you can be put in jail. If you're an American dependency, like El Salvador, you get your brains blown out. That's what we do to dissidents. But in the United States, like the Jesuit intellectuals in 1989. But if you're in the United States, there's essentially no penalties. Unless you really get involved in serious resistance activities, as I've done, and so on. But then you choose it. You don't have to do that. Well, I think that's a pretty good definition of a kind of cowardice, moral cowardice. And even beyond it is the fact that the values are internalized.
Mm-hmm.
So you can perceive yourself as adversarial, courageous, challenging power, and so on, but on grounds that are so narrow that it just supports violence and terror. Take, say, the Iraq War. Obama is highly praised for being a principled critic of the Iraq War from early on. What did he say? He said it's a strategic blunder. I mean, you could have read that in Pravda in 1985 when Russian, the Communist Party spokesmen were saying, it was stupid to get into Afghanistan, strategic blunder. In fact, you could have heard it from the Nazi general staff after Stalingrad.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to fight a two-front war was a strategic blunder, should have knocked out England first. I mean, is that principled criticism? Well, when that's presented as principled criticism, it's worse than flag waving, much worse, because it gives a sort of superficial impression of criticism. And what it's actually saying is, okay, here are the bounds. You can go this far and not 1 millimeter farther. And this far means everything we did is sort of well-intentioned, but we make mistakes. Now, if you go through a long period, say the Vietnam War, that went on for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You get to the end of the Vietnam War in 1975. You read the retrospectives. They're quite interesting. I mean, the most critical commentator that I know in the media is probably Anthony Lewis of the New York Times, way off on the dissident end.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a review of what happened. He said that we began with blundering efforts to do good. Blundering because it didn't work, efforts to do good because it's a tautology. If the United States did it, it was efforts to do good.
Mm-hmm.
So we began with blundering efforts to do good, but by 1969, it was clear that it's a disaster and we cannot achieve our marvelous aims, bringing democracy and so on, except at a cost too great to ourselves. That's the retrospective. I mean, you destroy three countries, you kill millions of people, and we know the reasons why it was done. It's not
mm-hmm.
efforts to do good, and we'll go into them. But in fact, the U.S. sort of won its war aims. But the only thing that's wrong is it was going to cost us too much. That's at the extreme dissident end. I mean, of course, there are others, but within the mainstream. Now, what does that tell you? It's much more dangerous than when some, Glenn Beck or someone says, we should go in there and kill them all. Much more dangerous because this looks like, this sets the bounds of criticism.
Yeah.
Now, when people, there's all this talk about the liberal media and people on the left refute it and so on. I agree with it. I think the media tend to be liberal and I think they're much more dangerous for that reason. Because their liberalism is setting the limits of possible criticism. So look how bold we are. We even said it was a mistake, strategic blunder. Well, that means you can't go beyond that. If you go beyond that, you're just kind of off on Mars or something. But And that technique, I wouldn't say technique because it's not planned. It's just like instinctive. It's acculturation. You're incorporated into an intellectual culture which doesn't see anything funny about this. And that means if anybody wants to go beyond, let's say your students, they must be crazy or Marxists or whatever the current word of abuse is, terrorists or something. And it's astonishing the way it works. I mean, take the original sins of this society.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first one was extermination of the indigenous population. Extermination is the word that was used, for example, by John Quincy Adams and for Secretary of War and so on. So they knew what they were doing. They were exterminating the indigenous population, many millions of people, conquering half of Mexico and so on. Occasionally you get a reference to it. I've just seen two references in two of the world's leading intellectual journals, kind of leftish, left liberal intellectual journals. One is the New York Review of Books in the United States. The other is the London Review of Books in London. They're kind of sister publications, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
And they're about as far as you can go in criticism and be anywhere within the range of respectability. Well, there was an article about 8 or 9 months ago in the New York Review, a review of a book of American history, a major historian, Edmund Morgan. And the reviewer was a kind of a noted liberal political analyst, says that he was surprised at how much he learned from this book. He learned that when Columbus arrived, the hemisphere was empty. There were only about 1 million people, kind of hunter-gatherers scattered around, no society, no culture. He was off by maybe 80 or 90 million.
Slight factor.
They had advanced civilizations. Not different from the Europeans, except in the means of warfare. And of course, they're not all gone. And here, they're mostly gone. North America, it's in territory of the United States by the year 1900, I think it was down to a couple hundred thousand.
Yeah.
It's increased since. Not a letter, not a comment. The London Review of Books, I think it's in the current issue, has an article about the conflict over the Armenian genocide. And they quote the senator who was pushing it, the resolution, and the article says, well, he started out ritually, just to show his good faith, by referring to the American mistreatment of the native population. It's like talking about the Nazi mistreatment of the Jews. We wouldn't accept that. Yeah. But this is fine. If we carried out, the word genocide isn't strong enough to describe it, but whatever you want to describe it as, it didn't happen. And we can deny it with impunity and with a sense of integrity and courage and, we're critical intellectuals and so on. I mean, pretty much the same is true of the second original sin, slavery. I mean, it's assumed, what you learn in school is that slavery ended with the Emancipation Proclamation. It didn't. There was a period of about 10 years Reconstruction when slavery formally ended. Then there was a compact between North and South in 1877, and something was instituted which is probably worse than slavery, namely criminalization of the black population. So if a black man is standing on a street corner, he can be arrested for vagrancy. Maybe the fine is $25, but by the time he tries to pay off the corrupt judge and a bunch of lawyers, he's in jail for life. If he looks the wrong way at a white woman, he can be arrested for attempted rape. I mean, they essentially criminalized the population. And that's a very significant part of U.S. economic development. That's a large part of the core of the Industrial Revolution. I mean, there were the criminalized workforce was sent back to be slave labor. They worked in the cotton fields and chain gangs. They worked in the mines. U.S. Steel employed them and so on. It's a big piece of American industrial history. It lasted until the Second World War. In the Second World War, they needed you know, what's called free labor for the war effort. So that system ended. And the Second World War, there were jobs. You know, you work in war industry. The Second World War, thanks to substantial government intervention, obviously, laid the basis for the economic boom of the next couple of decades. And during that period, you know, a black worker from the South could get a job in Detroit, you know, auto industry, buy a home, you know, buy a car, you know, kids go to school, mm-hmm. and so on. Well, you know, that ended in the 1970s. In the 1970s, with the decision to financialize the economy, which meant, all as a corollary, means hollowing out productive industry. It doesn't end. You just produce, you know, in Mexico or in China or Vietnam or something. So for the owners and the banks, it's wonderful, but it meant removing the opportunities here. How did we react to that? By criminalizing the black population, right back to post-Reconstruction. So if you go back to, say, 1980, the U.S. Prison population was, per capita, was pretty much like the other rest of the industrial world. I mean, now it's 5 to 10 times as high, all on the pretext of the drug war is the main thing. And it's mostly black and Hispanic now. So you're tossing the superfluous population back into prison, and they're being used for prison labor, often in violation of international conventions. I mean, it's not identical to the post-slavery situation, but remarkably similar. In fact, if you look at the history of Afro-Americans, I mean, since they were first brought to this hemisphere, they've had a couple of decades of relative freedom. I mean, that's a fairly serious matter, I would think. If that's not headline news, I don't know what is. And you can find it, and it's not secret. In fact, the post-slavery story happens to be very eloquently described and in great detail by a Wall Street Journal correspondent. The head of the Atlanta Bureau of the Wall Street mm-hmm. Journal wrote articles in the journal about it and has a book about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's not secret. It just doesn't enter consciousness, just as the, you know, the fate of the indigenous population doesn't enter consciousness. Well, to keep things out of consciousness, that's significant. Actually, Orwell had something to say about this, too. He wrote an article which probably very few people have read because it wasn't published. It was the introduction to Animal Farm. Everybody's read Animal Farm. But the introduction to it didn't appear. Nobody knows whether it was suppressed or what happened. The introduction to it was about what he called literary censorship in England. And the thrust was, okay, this book is a kind of a caricature of this horrible totalitarian state, but we shouldn't feel too self-righteous about it, because in free England, it's, you know, they're similar phenomena. And he discusses them, but two or three lines of explanation which capture what's going on pretty well.
Our guest you've been listening to is Noam Chomsky. And first, I hear the band tuning up in the background, Professor Chomsky, which means they have to clear us out of the studio. It has been a wonderful honor to have you here today on Media Matters. I could talk to you forever. We should do a telethon or something. Again, thank you very much. I want to thank Mike Pritchard for being my engineer today. Melissa Trent's my producer. Be back 1 week from today. Thank you all, listeners. Goodbye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, today will be breezy with occasional showers and isolated thunderstorms, a high around 60 degrees. Tonight, showers are likely with a low of 45. Monday, mostly cloudy with a 30% chance of rain, a high of 58. Monday night, mostly cloudy with a low of 43. And Tuesday, partly sunny with a high of 63. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana. Yeah.